Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram Weekend Edition, published Saturday, December 17th, 2022. Front page. Midland jobless rate dips. Unemployment falls to 2.8% in November. By Mella McEwen. Midland has returned to the top of the state's labor markets it dominated for several years during the shale boom before being knocked off its throne by the COVID-19 pandemic. The Texas Workforce Commission said Friday its Midland Metropolitan Statistical Area, MSA, which includes Midland and Martin counties, recorded an unemployment rate of 2.8% in November, down from 2.9% in October and 4.3% last November. That puts the tall city in a three-way tie with Amarillo and Austin Round Rock MSAs for lowest unemployment statewide. Odessa saw similar improvement, falling to 4% from 4.2% in October and from 6.2% last November. I would definitely say we've made a full recovery from the pandemic, said Willie Taylor, chief executive officer of the commission's Workforce Solutions Permian Basin office, which serves 17 West Texas counties. We've been steadily moving in the right direction, Taylor told the Reporter Telegram by telephone. This just tells how strong this economy is. I was looking at its historical record, and we haven't seen rates like this since 2017-2019. He said the region continues to need skilled workers in a variety of fields, from healthcare to oil and gas, transportation to education. Everyone's doing heavy recruiting, he said, from the major operators to major service companies like Halliburton to other industries. Taylor added that the region is seeing an influx of new residents from other areas as varied as El Paso to Louisiana to Oklahoma, as he observed to a graduate student recently. Another source of optimism for Taylor is what he called the pipeline of future workers is well stocked. People are in training in bullish trades, welding, commercial driver's license, education, he said. We have a good pipeline. It will be a slow process. We're also reaching out to the rural communities to ensure they know what the target occupations are and what we need. Midland's civilian labor force showed strength, jumping by 700 to 104,705 from 104,002 in October, and more than 1,000 from last November's 103,660. The number of employed Midlanders also jumped by nearly 800 to 101,760 from 100,937 in October, and is up by more than 2,500 from 99,216 last year. The number of unemployed Midlanders fell by more than 100 to 2,945 from 3,065 in October. That number has fallen by about 1,500 over the year from November 2021's 4,444 unemployed. Midland added 900 total non-farm jobs from October to November for a job count of 109,500. The MSA's dominant industry sector, mining, logging, and construction, led with 400 new jobs, followed by trade, transportation, and utilities with 300 jobs. The professional and business services and government sectors each added 100 jobs. All other sectors remained stable, with Taylor noting there were no declines during the month. For the 12 months from November 2021 to November 2022, Midland added 4,300 jobs for a growth rate of 4.1%. Mining, logging, and construction again led with the creation of 2,600 new jobs. Leisure and hospitality was second with 600 new jobs. The manufacturing, the trade, transportation and utility sector, the professional and business services sector, education and health services sector, and other services sector each added 200 jobs. Financial activities added 100 jobs. Statewide, Texas saw its unemployment rate dip to 3.7% from 3.8% in October. The state also recorded a full year of setting monthly records for jobs, reporting 13,672,900 jobs in November, up 33,600 from October. The state added 657,600 jobs annually. While the Midland, Amarillo, and Austin Round Rock reported the state's lowest unemployment, McAllen Edinburgh Mission saw the highest at 6.4%. Personal income rate soars. Midlands ranks third in U.S. based on per capita by Stuart Doreen. Helped by the nation's largest yearly increase, Midland ranked third in the U.S. for per capita personal income in 2021, according to a Bureau of Economic Analysis report released this week. Consistently, one of the top performers on the annual list, Midland moved from fifth overall in 2020 with the per capita personal income of $109,263 to third in 2021, $125,455. Midland topped the BEA's list in 2019, $141,994. The 14.8% increase in the Midland metropolitan area was nearly 2 percentage points better than number two Abilene, which showed a 12.9% increase from 2021 to 2022. Still, Midland reigns supreme across the Lone Star State. The metropolitan area with the next largest per capita personal income, according to the BEA, was Austin Round Rock Georgetown, which ranked 31st, $71,372. Dallas-Fort Worth Arlington was 47th, $66,727. The next highest-ranked West Texas metropolitan area was San Angelo, which ranked 104th, $60,187. Odessa ranked 203rd, $53,610. Across the nation, the metropolitan areas with the highest per capita personal income were San Jose, Sunnyvale, Santa Clara, California, $136,338. Bridgeport, Stamford, Norwalk, Connecticut, $127,391. And Midland. San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, California, $123,711. And Naples, Marco Island, Florida, $117,984, rounded out the top five and were the only other two metropolitan areas with per capita income at or above $100,000. Midland's per capita personal income has climbed, fallen, and again climbed with the resurgence in oil. USGS reports 5.4 magnitude earthquake north-northwest of Midland. By Mercedes Cordero. The U.S. Geologic Survey reported a 5.4 magnitude earthquake north-northwest of Midland. The earthquake took place around 5:35 p.m. Friday, 14 miles north-northwest of Midland in Martin County, with a depth of 5.6 miles, according to the USGS. It was tied for the third strongest earthquake in Texas history, according to EarthquakeTrack.com. It equaled the magnitude of the earthquake that happened 1 month earlier west of Mentone in far west Texas. The USGS stated a second quake took place just minutes after, a 3.3 magnitude tremor at 5:38 p.m., less than 1 mile from the location of the stronger earthquake. A quake with a magnitude of 2.5 to 5.4 is often felt but only causes minor damage, according to UPSIS, an educational site for seismologists. There are about 30,000 quakes each year, according to the site. Residents asked to report damages from earthquake. Ready Midland, Midland County's emergency management agency, is asking county residents to report any damage experienced from Friday's 5.3 magnitude earthquake. Reporting damage using the damage assessment form is a voluntary activity, is not a substitute for reporting damage to your insurance agency, and does not guarantee disaster relief assistance, according to the press release. The objective of the survey is to identify damages across Midland County to help your local emergency management officials gain an understanding of damages that have occurred during recent natural disaster activity, the county said in a press release. Online video leads to arrest of Odessa High student. by Mercedes Cordero. A video making its rounds on social media Friday morning led to the arrest of an Odessa high school student, according to Ector County ISD. ECISD police at OHS were shown a video on social media that showed a person with a weapon. It was reported the video was shot on or near the OHS campus. The OHS campus was put into secure, which means students remain in their current classrooms or locations, and the entrances are locked and monitored, according to the press release. Officers did not find the suspect in the video after searching OHS. The investigation led them to Crockett Middle School, but again, no suspect was found, according to the press release. After carefully analyzing the video, police determined that it was recorded near Whitaker Avenue on the west side of OHS campus. ECISD officers, along with Odessa Police Department, Department of Public Safety, and Medical Center Hospital district officers, returned to OHS in an effort to identify the person in the video. Police were able to locate the suspect, a student who was arrested for threat, exhibition of a firearm on a school or bus, a Class A misdemeanor. Police have determined the video is older and was not recorded Friday, the district said in a press release. ECISD officials want to thank those who reported this video, our staffs and students at the two schools who handled the situation calmly and safely, and the officers who responded and worked diligently to find the location of the video and the person in it. We know our local law enforcement is dedicated to keeping our community and our schools safe, the district said in a statement. Midland woman arrested after hitting child with cord by Mercedes Cordero. A 38-year-old woman was arrested Wednesday after Texas Child Protective Services contacted Midland police about possible child abuse, according to court documents. Blanca Veda was being held in Midland County Jail for injury to a child, elderly, or disabled individual with intention of bodily injury, a third-degree felony charge. She was released on a $25,000 bond. Detectives with the Midland Police Department were contacted Wednesday by CPS in reference to possible child abuse. CPS told detectives that a 7-year-old child had a marking on his face and stated Vega had hit him in the face with a cord. During an interview with Child Advocacy Center, the child disclosed that Vega hit him with the cable on the face because he stole $100 from her, according to the arrest affidavit. He also stated he had similar markings on his leg. Vega was interviewed by detectives and was shown pictures of the child's injuries. She admitted to hitting him with the cord, according to the arrest affidavit. Drilling activity weighed down by falling oil prices by Mella McEwen. Softening crude prices continued to weigh on drilling activity as the rig count declined for a second consecutive week. Oilfield services firm Baker Hughes said Friday its U.S. rig count, which has published weekly since the 1940s, fell by 4 to 776 for the week. Still, the count is 197 rigs, or 34%, higher than the 579 reported this time last year. The number of rigs drilling for crude oil fell by 5, the steepest decline since September, and the lowest in 6 weeks, to 620. Still 145 higher than the 475 counted last year. The number of rigs drilling for natural gas rose 1 to 154, 50 more than 104 last December. Texas saw its rig count drop by 3 rigs to 367, 92 higher than the 275 at work statewide last year. New Mexico added 1 rig for 107 rigs. Colorado, 1. North Dakota, 1, Oklahoma, 1, and Wyoming, 2, joined Texas as producing states to see declines. Alaska, 1, and Louisiana, 2, joined New Mexico as producing states to see increases. The Permian Basin reported 350 rigs drilling throughout the region for a third consecutive week, 62 more than the 288 at work last year. Lee County, New Mexico remains the most active county in the Permian with 69 rigs, down 3 for the week, and the steepest decline among Permian counties. Martin County was second with 36 rigs, up 2 for the week. Eddy County, New Mexico, was close behind with 35 rigs, up 4 for the week, the sharpest increase in the week. Reeves County had 33 rigs, down 1 for the week. Midland County reported 31 rigs, down 1. Loving County hosted 23 rigs for a second consecutive week, while Howard County reported 20 rigs for a second week. Ward County had 19 rigs, unchanged for the week, and Upton County had 15 rigs for a third week. Glasscock County had 13 rigs, down 1. In Veris Foundations, part of the energy-focused software as a service firm in Veris, said its U.S. rig count's highest point for the week, ending December 14th, was 860, sliding by 17 from the previous week. The count was down 1% in the last month, but up 21% in the last year. In the last week, the Permian and the DJ Basin tallied increases, up by 3 rigs to 325, and by 1 rig to 21, while Appalachia was flat at 56 rigs. The Anadarko Basin fell by 4 rigs to a total of 87, and the Willitson Basin dropped by 2 to 41. The Gulf Coast dropped a rig at 118. Oil price rally cut short by looming recession fears, by Mella McEwen. An oil price rally that sent prices near $80 a barrel was undercut by week's end as recession fears overshadowed plans by the U.S. government to refill the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange got off to a strong start, rising $2.15 Monday and an additional $2.22 Tuesday and $1.89 Wednesday before recession concerns took hold. Prices retreated $1.17 Thursday and closed the week falling an additional $1.82, or by 2.4%, to end at $74.29 per barrel, still above the $71.02 at last Friday's close. The posted price ended at $70.77, according to Plains All American. Natural gas prices also started off strong during its trading week, rising 34 cents to $6.59 per MCF Monday, and an additional 35 cents Tuesday to $6.935, before sinking 50 cents to $6.43, rising 54 cents to $6.97, and then dropping 37 cents Friday to end the week at $6.60 per MCF. That's still above the $6.245 at last Friday's close. I'm happy to see the DOE planning to start refilling the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, commented Steve Pruitt, President and Chief Executive Officer of Elevation Resources and Chairman of the Independent Petroleum Association of America, by email to the Reporter Telegram. This country needs a full oil reserve to fulfill its SPR's intended purpose, to provide oil to refineries in times of natural disasters or war. I do not think that 3 million barrels of purchases to be delivered in February will materially affect oil prices. The challenge the upstream oil and gas industry faces is that drilling completion and production costs have inflated based on rising activity levels, driven by $100 oil prices and $6 natural gas prices in the second and third quarters of 2022, he wrote. The E&P companies that I follow have overspent their budgets due to inflation in the cost of materials like tubulars, services, and wages, he wrote. As a result of the profit margin squeeze, E&P companies have reduced activity in the fourth quarter. There has been some softening of service pricing, particularly in the completion area, where drilled but incomplete wells, DUCs, have increased, he noted. Returns on drilling investments are getting pressured, he wrote, between 30-plus percent cost inflation from the COVID lows in drilling and completion costs and oil prices in the low 70s and natural gas prices in the Permian below $2 per MCF after processing costs. It's too early to know how this margin squeeze will affect 2023 budgets, but oil company leaders and their boards will need to trim capital budgets if costs don't decline or if commodity prices don't improve, he cautioned. Given the upstream oil and gas industry funds it's drilling out of cash flow, if cash flow declines, drilling and completion activity will have to decline. For Pruitt, the medium-term outlook for pricing is bullish given chronic underinvestment in the global oil and gas industry. However, he wrote the short-term price outlook is difficult to predict due to the looming global recession, Federal Reserve and central bank interest rate increases, Russian President Putin's continued use of energy as a weapon, and the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries' actions to balance the oil market. The long-term outlook on oil and natural gas prices is affected by government policies and regulations purported to mitigate climate change, policies that seek to eliminate oil and natural gas, which is devastating to improvements in the quality of life in developing countries, Africa and India, and harmful to economically challenged populations in developed countries of the Western world, he wrote. Did party politics fire Odessa city staff? By Jane Lozano and Pooja Sohurta, Texas Tribune, Lubbock. When progressive-era advocates pushed for municipal elections to be nonpartisan, they sought to remove party politics from local government. More than a century later, party politics appear to have seeped back into the down-ballot races, injecting political ideology into municipal affairs in places like Odessa. During a town meeting this week, the Republican-backed majority on Odessa's nonpartisan city council voted as a block to terminate two city employees, the city manager and city attorney, without clear cause. The vote came just weeks after three new city council members were sworn into office, and before those new members had spent significant time working with the employees they let go. Mayor Javier Hoven and four council members, all of whom have been supported by the Ector County Republican Party, voted to fire the two employees, City Manager Michael Marrero and City Attorney Natasha Brooks. Marrero, who has been employed by the city since 1994, declined to comment for this story. And Brooks, who has worked for the city since 2015, could not be reached for comment. The council's decision to fire the two workers was met by uproar from Odessa citizens. I'm flabbergasted by what just happened today, Filberto Gonzalez, a former Odessa City Council member, said during the meeting. People came into the city council without doing their due diligence. Historically, municipal government's responsibilities, such as waste management, waste water distribution, and public safety, have not been considered highly political. That's why nearly all local elections across the country are nonpartisan, meaning a candidate's party affiliation is not printed on the ballot. But even general housekeeping duties have become highly polarized along political lines in recent years, causing a friction on even the most mundane issues. Perhaps most notable are school boards across Texas and the nation. Disagreements over critical race theory, library books, and history curriculums have turned school boards into political battlegrounds. In Tarrant County, for example, the conservative PAC, Patriot Mobile Action, spent about $390,000 on four consecutive candidates running for local school board. During the Odessa City Council meeting, community members stepped up to the podium one by one to tell their elected leaders that they were out of line and have acted without listening to their constituents. Many spoke favorably of the two fired employees and said they were confused about why council members fired competent workers without an explanation. Although several community members spoke up during the meeting, they were upset they got a chance to comment only after the council had already booted out the two employees. They should have been allowed to speak prior to the vote, citizens argued. In a heated address to the council, one local attorney said he intends to sue the council for violating citizens' rights. Mr. Mayor, please understand I'm filing a suit against the city, Attorney Gavin Norris said. You've disenfranchised my voice. Norris said the lawsuit was in the works before the meeting took place and that he had added the events from this week's meeting to the lawsuit. He declined to comment on the additional motivation for the lawsuit. The lawsuit has not been filed. In a statement, Hoven defended the council's action without providing a reason for the two terminations. The citizens of Odessa voted for change in the November election, and the majority of our city council and myself are on board with continuing to move our community forward, he said. Council is committed to continually improve every aspect of the city. After extensive review, council determined this type of change would require an adjustment in the day-to-day leadership of the city. The Ector County Republican Party did not respond to requests for comment. In a prior interview with local media, party chair Tisha Crow said she was excited that Odessa would be represented by a new city council majority comprised of conservative, God-fearing Republican patriots. Hannah Horick, the chair for Ector County Democratic Party, said there are now serious concerns about whether this was a good move for Odessa or even legal. When these substantial changes happen in concert with local Republican leadership, including precinct chairs and a county chair, it's hard not to wonder if there are blatant violations of the Open Meetings Act, Horick said, or just efforts that might skirt the letter of the law. Horick said Odessa has become more politicized under Hoven, who is the first Hispanic mayor of Odessa. We've seen a partisan and divided city government since he took office in late 2020, Horick said. It's no surprise to me that now that they have secured additional votes in this block of Republicans, that they would go and try to make a substantial change. Midland Reporter Telegram obituaries published Saturday, December 17th, 2022. Denise Annette Carol Humphrey. Denise Annette Carol Humphrey was born in Lubbock on December 17th, 1964. To Ronnie and Joan Jody G. Carroll. She married the love of her life, Douglas Edward Humphrey, in 1986. Over the course of 7 years, Denise and Doug welcomed three children, Peyton, Caleb, and Tess, into their lives, and they became her pride and joy. In July 2018, she gained a wonderful daughter-in-law, Stephanie. In the summer of 2022, she got her wish of becoming a grandma, to little Mia, who was her greatest treasure. She's preceded in death by her father, Ronnie Carroll, her grandparents, Johnny and Pearl Giovingo, Garland and Maddie Carroll, and numerous aunts and uncles. She leaves behind her children, Doug, her children, Peyton, Caleb, and his wife, Stephanie, Tess, and a granddaughter, Mia. She also leaves behind her mother and sister and a loving niece and nephews and a future son-in-law, Peyton Sales. The family has chosen to do a celebration of her life in the springtime. Janet Blount. Julia Janet Blount found her way to her heavenly home, Jesus and Pa, on Saturday morning, December 3rd, having waited 42 years to join her beloved Richard and to dance with him again. She was born August 5th, 1940, to Willie B. and Jesse Lee Hudson in Pampa, Texas. She married Richard D. Blount September 2nd, 1960, in Odessa. She was preceded in death by her parents, her beloved husband Richard, and a stepson, Richard Blount. Janet is survived by her two daughters, Teresa Alexander and husband Mark, and Pamela Mounts and husband Mark, two stepsons, Daryl Blount and wife Sue, and Danny Blount and wife Zan. Surviving are 11 children and 11 great-grandchildren, as well as numerous friends and extended family members. A graveside ceremony and interment at Sunset Memorial will be held December 27th at 10:30 a.m. Leanne K. Hedges. Leanne K. Hedges, 62, of Midland, passed away peacefully on Monday, December 12th. Memorial Mass will be held Monday, December 19th at 10 a.m. at St. Stephen's Catholic Church in Midland. Leanne was born on January 23, 1960, to John Dolores Burke in Boone, Iowa. She met and married the love of her life in Georgetown, Colorado, February 17, 1979. After having their first child, Ashley, they moved to Midland. She is survived by her husband of 43 years, Charles F. Hedges, Jr., her two children, daughter Ashley Garza and her spouse Robert Garza, son John Hedges, her four grandchildren, who were her world, and many nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her father, John Burke, and her grandmother, lovingly named Goose. In lieu of flowers, Leanne would like to have wanted you to choose a child from the giving tree to dress and gift for Christmas. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Online condolences can be made at npwelch.com. Winona Frazier. Winona Nona Ruth Frazier, 72 of Midland, departed from the boundaries of her heavenly home December 8, 2022, and was welcomed into her eternal home in heaven to be with her Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Nona was born October 28, 1950, in Midland, to Maxine and Alvis Nikitin. Nona was very proud of her Christian faith and the church family that she belonged to. While a member of the church and leading by her example, Nona raised three God-fearing children with her previous husband, Carl Ray Hollum Sr., who preceded her in death in 2015. In 2017, Nona met and married Billy C. Frazier and would spend five wonderful years with him. Nona is survived by her husband, Billy C. Frazier of Midland, two sisters, Royce Brown of Midland, Therese Taylor, and husband Jerry of Parsons, Kansas, five brothers, Norman Nikitin and his wife Bonnie of Midland, Clifford Nikitin of Midland, Kelly Nikitin of and his wife Sheila of Midland, Ronald Nikitin of Burnett, Texas, and Jeff Nikitin and his wife Janelle of Midland. She's also survived by her three children, Rachel, Shelley, Martin, and husband Gregory of Midland, William Hollins and wife Alicia of Midland, Cara Hollins and wife Lori of Crum, Texas, stepson Josh Frazier and wife Jennifer of Hutto, Texas, stepdaughter J. Ann Sanderson and husband Dan of Apopka, Florida. 11 grandchildren, along with several nieces, nephews, great nieces, and great nephews. There will be a visitation with friends and family on Sunday, December 18th at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home, 2508 North Big Spring Street, Midland, Texas, from 6 to 8 p.m. A celebration of Nona's life will be held at the Midland Church of God, 5300 Thomason Drive, Midland, on Monday, December 19th at 11 a.m. Graveside services will follow immediately at Fairview Cemetery in Midland. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations are made to a charity or organization of your choice in Nona's honor. Funeral service is under the direction of the Llewellyn Pipkin Garcia Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Death notices from Saturday. Denise Humphrey. Denise Humphrey, 57, of Midland, passed away December 9th, 2022. There will be a service held at a later date. Arrangements under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Pauline Fox. Pauline Fox, 89, of Midland, passed away Thursday, December 15th, 2022. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, December 21st at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 12 p.m. Thursday, December 22nd at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements under the direction of Nallie Pickle-Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at npwelch.com. Ramon Garcia Ponce, 76, passed away Wednesday, December 14th. Viewing will be Tuesday, December 20th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., with an evening service at 6 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Arrangements were made with Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin at nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com.
This is Jane reading for the OA for Saturday, December 17th. City staff call elected officials bullies. Some say atmosphere is toxic, fear for jobs. While Tuesday's canning of Odessa City Manager Michael Marrero and City Attorney Natasha Brooks has dominated the headlines the last few days, there's someone else many are talking about, downtown Odessa Executive Director Casey Hallmark. After a handful of people got up to blast the city council for voting 5-2 to fire Marrero and Brooks without explanation, Hallmark went up to the podium to add her 2 cents, but she shocked many when she took it even further. She accused new council member Chris Haney of screaming at her and said Mayor Javier Hoven told her the police department is full of murderers and she needed to watch her back. She also accused council member Mark Mata of bullying and intimidating her. Speaking to Hoven, she said, "The dirty politics have made this job unbearable. You came to my office so many times. You were right here when I went to shake your hand 3 weeks ago into my job, and you told me you'd accept my letter of resignation. You told the public to fire me and rescind my offer because I'm a crazy liberal." She went on to say how sad she is as a lifelong member of the city. "This is my city. This is our city, and you're making a mockery of it. The way that you come to council and fight and belittle people, the things you do behind the scene is absolutely repugnant," Hallmark said. "I love my city. I absolutely love my job. But at some point, somebody has to stand up and say, this is bananas. You guys cannot and should not treat city employees this way." She is not alone in her view of certain members of the city council. Prior to Tuesday night's vote, 4 City of Odessa employees expressed their anger and sadness at the thought of losing the pair and described the atmosphere at City Hall as toxic. All of them requested anonymity for fear of reprisals. In interviews after the fact, they spoke of Hallmark's bravery and said people are even more fearful now that they've seen what can happen when somebody gets crossways with the council. "They're really, really scared. Who's next? That's the general sentiment," one said. "It's a very sad time to be a City of Odessa employee." Requests for interviews were sent via emails, text, and voicemails were sent to Hoven and the rest of the city council before and after the meeting, seeking comments on the employees' allegations. City Secretary Norma Aguilar-Grimaldo said the soonest Hoven would be available is January 9th, as he's going out of town. District 1 City Council member Mark Mata released this statement on Thursday. "We are dedicated to working with the staff to make this a successful and unified transition. At this moment, we want to ensure the city employees that we are in a great position and have their best interests in mind. We are prioritizing citywide initiatives and confident that our city management will match those initiatives with our highest performing and most capable leaders. We as a council look forward to introducing these plans and involving the community as we improve Odessa. I'm very proud of our city employees and will work with them to make this city not only a great place to work, but also a great city to live." District 3 council member Gilbert Vasquez, who voted against firing Marrero and Brooks, said he had a favorable impression of them, but hadn't had a chance to really evaluate them. He was sworn in November 22nd. "As for the employees, they certainly have the right and freedom to express their views and concerns." In a text following the meeting, Hallmark said her decision to speak was spontaneous, but I did what I felt was right, and I'm proud of that. On Thursday, Hallmark said she hasn't filed any formal complaints because she feared retaliation, but did tell her supervisor after every incident. I have been reached out to by over 50 city employees who said they were thankful I stood up and spoke my truth. Many are fearful of retaliation and have been with the city for 10-plus years, so they have way more to lose, Hallmark said. She declined to comment further, saying she is seeking legal counsel. Speaking separately, each of the four employees, speaking anonymously, said the working environment at the city had grown toxic in recent months. They said a growing number of employees have come to believe Hovind Mata and council member Denise Swinner targeted Marrero and Brooks because they were not yes men. All three were elected in a runoff election in 2020 after failing to gain the 50% needed in their races to win outright. Hovind served as District 5 council member from 1996 to 1999 when he resigned abruptly at the end of his second term. He ran in 2010 but lost. Certain council members claim to be doing the thing that will benefit the city, but in reality, they're only trying to benefit themselves. They want to push their agenda, one employee said. The city council should be more focused on pressing issues such as infrastructure instead of becoming a sanctuary city or banning game rooms, some of the employees agreed. It seems like a power grab, and I think it's also an opportunity for glory. I'm someone's boss, and I get to say what happens. They're just taking the opportunity to really humiliate people. It feels like they're just tossing their weight around. Yet another said, I think it is a blatant abuse of power and a gathering of power by certain individuals on our city council. They're reaching out to city employees directly as opposed to the way it's supposed to be in a council or mayor government. It's quite uncomfortable, and it's almost to the point where you feel bullied. This is Jane, reading for the OA for Saturday, December 17th. Fill the stocking. Generous donor offers $50,000 challenge. Empty stocking fund deadline is extended until Wednesday. An anonymous and very generous Odessa businessman who has supported both the Salvation Army and the Empty Stocking Fund for years is offering up a holiday miracle for this year's struggling fundraiser. He will match the next $50,000 donated dollar for dollar to the Empty Stocking Fund. His generous challenge has encouraged us to extend our deadline for giving until Wednesday, December 21st. Hopefully this will get the donations needed for this year, the donor said. The 28th year of the Empty Stocking Fund was scheduled to end Friday with a $100,000 goal to meet the needs in our community. The goal, however, seemed out of reach with just over $18,000 raised since Thanksgiving. The fund helps families who are struggling to make ends meet. Many are single moms and grandmothers trying to raise families in tough times. Funds donated to the Empty Stocking stay in Ector County and help local families. All families who receive help have been vetted by the Salvation Army. The Empty Stocking Fund, an annual fundraising effort by the Odessa American and the Salvation Army, provides a good holiday meal and small gifts under the tree for needy seniors and children. Donations to the Empty Stocking Fund may be made, mailed, or delivered to the Salvation Army Community Center at 810 East 11th Street or the Odessa American, 700 North Grant Street, Suite 800. Zip codes for both are 79761. Or you can call the Salvation Army at 432-332-0738. This is Jane reading for the OA for Saturday, December 17th. Baby death moms accused hearing bond held. An attorney was unsuccessful Friday in trying to get the bond reduced for an Odessa woman facing a potential life sentence in the July death of her baby from $200,000 to $10,000. Defense attorney Matt Powell told Judge Dan Whalen of the 70th Ector County District Court that $10,000 would be enough to ensure Layla Pearson, 18, would not flee and would make all of her court appearances. He also said his client would be willing to wear a GPS monitor if released from the Ector County Jail. Pearson and Cameron Gamage were arrested in July after dispatchers received a 911 call from the Brady Apartments on East 52nd Street about an unresponsive baby and found their 7-month-old son, Logan, dead, his head covered in bruises. An autopsy revealed the child had also been strangled. Gamage, 23, pled guilty to murder and injury to a child before he was even arraigned on the charges and was sentenced to life in prison plus 20 years. Pearson was originally arrested on the state felony charge of injury to a child, but the grand jury later indicted her on 2 counts of injury to a child, but increased them to a first-degree felony charge, which is punishable by 5 years to life in prison. During Friday's hearing, Pearson's mother, Kristen Polson, and former stepfather, Ray Durham, were called to the stand by Powell. As her tearful daughter watched, a rosary around her neck, Polson testified she was misled about Gamage's age when he began dating her daughter when she was 15, but was not allowed to answer questions as to whether Gamage was violent toward her daughter or if she'd ever seen injuries on her daughter because the judge ruled the answers irrelevant. Under cross-examination from Assistant Ector County District Attorney Elizabeth Howard, Polson acknowledged Pearson lived with the Gamages of her own free will, despite the fact that she was welcome at her mother's house. Durham, a Fort Stockton rancher, testified he raised Pearson from the time she was 1 until 14, and she is welcome to live with him and work for him. He said he could afford to pay $10,000 bond per count. Whatever he says goes, Durham said when asked if he'd be willing to make sure Pearson abided by any conditions the judge might impose. Under cross-examination, Durham said he hadn't been in court with Pearson for a few years after his divorce from her mother. He said he reached out to offer his help after seeing her mugshot on the news, as any daddy would do, I would hope. Powell also put Odessa Police Homicide Sergeant Justin Cade on the stand. The attorney asked the supervisor of the homicide division if Pearson told him Gamage had threatened her so she wouldn't speak with the police about her baby's death. The detective acknowledged Pearson told him about some verbal threats made to her by Gamage, but said he could not recall the specifics. Cade told Powell he has not seen any pictures from prior to Logan's birth showing a pregnant Pearson with bruises and strangulation marks. He acknowledged, however, he hasn't seen the results of a cell phone dump performed by other OPD personnel. Cade further acknowledged that the severity of Pearson's charges increased after the autopsy, despite the fact the autopsy did not provide any evidence she inflicted the child's wounds, and despite the fact that Gamage accepted full responsibility for those wounds. Under cross-examination from Howard, Cade testified Pearson was not crying or distraught the day the baby died, and she told him she and Gamage had tried to hide drug paraphernalia after calling 911. He also testified there were dirty diapers shoved under his playpen, and the dirty and unkempt house smelled of urine and feces. Howard then called Detective Donnie Rocha to the stand. Rocha testified he found a bong used for smoking marijuana in a closet in the apartment. Whalen denied Powell's motion, saying he found the bond reasonable when he said it, and he still thinks it's reasonable. This is Jane reading for the OA for Saturday, December 17th. Suspect arrested in connection with video. ECISD police at Odessa High School Friday morning were shown a social media video showing a person with a weapon. It was reported the video was shot on or near the OHS campus. When the video was recorded was unknown, a news release said. School leaders put the campus into secure, which means students remain in their current classrooms or locations, and the entrances are locked and monitored. After a search of the campus, the suspect in the video was not found, and it was believed the video may have come from a different school. Officers turned their focus to Crockett Middle School, but again, no suspect was found. A short time later, police determined the video was recorded near Whitaker Avenue on the west side of the OHS campus. ECISD officers, along with Odessa Police Department, Department of Public Safety, and Medical Center Hospital District officers, returned to OHS in an effort to identify the person in the video. Police were able to locate the suspect, a student, who was arrested for threat and exhibition of a firearm on a school bus, a Class A misdemeanor, the release said. Police have determined the video was older and was not recorded Friday. The campus was secured and operated on its normal early release schedule. ECISD officials want to thank those who reported this video, the staff and students at the two schools who handled the situation calmly and safely, and the officers who responded and worked diligently to find the location and the person in it. We know our local law enforcement is dedicating to keeping our community and our schools safe. A 34-year-old man was arrested Wednesday on a warrant that was issued when a childhood friend told Ector County Sheriff's deputies he hit him in the head with the barrel of an assault rifle and threatened to kill him. According to an ECSO report, deputies took a report on May 18th from a man who said he went to an address on West 10th Street to buy feed for his animals when he saw Raul Gutierrez Chavez. The man told deputies Chavez inexplicably became confrontational and aggressive, retrieved an assault rifle from his trunk, chambered a round, and pointed it at his head. He said Chavez hit him with the barrel of the gun at least twice, threatened his life. The man did not know what was going on and decided to leave as instructed, but was warned about retaliation if he was to notify authorities about the incident, the report said. According to the report, attempts to reach Chavez were unsuccessful. A warrant for aggravated assault with a deadly weapon was obtained, and he was booked into the Ector County Jail on Thursday. His bond has been set at $40,000, but Immigration and Customs Enforcement has also placed a hold on him. The charge is a second-degree felony, punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. This is Jane, reading for the OA for Saturday, December 17th. ECISD executive gets U.S. flag flown in her honor. It wasn't her birthday, but ECISD Executive Director of Talent Development, Ashley Osborne, got a special surprise Thursday with the delivery of an American flag that flew over the U.S. Capitol. Osborne said it was spurred by the talent development team that she leads at ECISD, who asked U.S. Representative August Pfluger's office for the recognition. My team actually reached out to Mr. Pfluger's office. It's my understanding that they have to request a flag be flown and give justification for why this person would deserve to have a flag flown over the Capitol. So I guess Mr. Pfluger's office reviews those requests and he makes the request to either the state or the U.S. Capitol. Osborne said, it was my understanding that initially my team was pursuing having the flag flown over the Texas Capitol, and then Mr. Pfluger actually had a U.S. flag flown over the Capitol on my behalf. So whenever they presented it to me yesterday, I was in complete shock. I was not expecting that at all. I was just so honored and thrilled and grateful to my team for believing that. She deserved to have a flag flown in her honor, Osborne said. After the photos with her, the flag was posted on Twitter. Pfluger commented on one of the tweets to thank Osborne for her service at ECISD. So I thought that was pretty special as well, Osborne said. She received two certificates, one from Pfluger's office and one from the architect of the Capitol, that certifies that the flag was flown on Osborne's behalf above the U.S. Capitol. In part, the certificate from the architect of the Capitol says, her dedication to students and teachers in public schools is remarkable and deserves recognition. ECISD's Talent Development is proud of her appointee to TEA Teacher Vacancy Task Force. The flag came through the U.S. Postal Service. It wasn't folded properly, and my team, they just put a lot of work into it. So like I said, they just made me feel really special because they watched YouTube videos and made sure the flag was well taken care of and folded properly into the case that it's in now, and then had the certificate framed for me as well. In a text message, Pfluger talked about the importance of educators' impact on the lives of students. As a father to three girls, I can personally speak to the influence that teachers and educators have on the lives of our youth. Ashley Osborne has demonstrated incredible service to our children, community, and the entire state of Texas. Her appointment to the Texas Education Agency Task Force is a testament to her leadership and impact, Pfluger said in the text message. She added that she's gratified that her team thought enough of her as their leader to do this. There are 15 people on the talent development team, including herself. The talent development team department is part of the Human Capital Division, and Human Resources is the other arm of the Human Capital Division. I will say, too, our human capital work here in ECISD has been receiving recognition in the state as well as the nation, because we're thinking differently about how we recruit, grow, develop, and retain staff. We're helping to inform some of the recommendations coming from the state. I sit on the Teacher Vacancy Task Force, and I'm a co-lead for the Talent Pipeline Working Group, she said. Recommendations from the Teacher Vacancy Task Force will be released in February. Those recommendations will inform policymaking. It will inform the legislature. It will inform our own state agency. It will inform the State Board of Education, certification, districts, campuses, and so the recommendations coming out of the Teacher Vacancy Task Force will really address challenges to all levels to help mitigate the challenges that we're currently seeing in teacher vacancies and teacher retention, Osborne said.